Hey guys, welcome back to the Amplify Horse Racing Podcast. So excited to share this episode with you. And we say it every time, it's so true, this is one of our best episodes. I'm so excited. We brought Sean Tugel, who is now the VP of Bloodstock at Eclipse Thoroughbred Partners, on. Sean and I go way back. He taught me a lot when I was a newbie at Windstar Farm, and he was working in the Bloodstock division while doing a lot of everything. As you will hear on this podcast, Sean grew up with a father who was a veterinarian at Finger Lakes, so got a lot of hands-on experience early on, and then at some point decided that he was ready to pack up and make a life in Lexington. And for the past 20 years, he has done that. He's worked for some of the biggest entities in the industry, doing a myriad of things, and has so much experience, both on the track, off the track, in the foaling barn, and really excited for our listeners to be able to listen to this one. We are so excited today to welcome Sean Tugel, the VP of Bloodstock at Eclipse Thoroughbred Partners, to the Amplify Horse Racing Podcast. Sean has a very long and varied history in the thoroughbred industry, so we're really excited to talk to him. Sean, just a little bit about you. We go way back a little bit. We were my first marketing job at Windstar. You were there working on the Bloodstock team, and so definitely learned a lot from you. I know you came up in the industry. I think you're from the New York region. Your father was a vet at Finger Lakes, and so you kind of grew up in it and then relocated to Lexington after college. And since then, you've worked for some of the biggest thoroughbred farms and entities in the, you know, in our industry, such as Hillendale. Obviously, we met at Windstar. I know you were at Windstar. You did so much there. And then also went to Gainsway, where you were the director of the stallion sales and recruitment. So excited to talk to you about your experience in the industry and how you got to where you are today, and hopefully share some knowledge.
Well, I appreciate having me on. Obviously, it's great. You know, we were all young people hungry to get into the industry at one time. And, you know, that's what makes our industry great, is there's always open doors for young people. And a lot of times, the way you jump in isn't always the path that you maintain. So it's a great part of our industry, is not only can it take you around the country, around the world. There's so many different avenues you can dive into. So thanks for having me on.
Yeah, welcome, Sean. Thank you so much for joining us. And you and I have crossed paths at many times at sales and different industry events, but I honestly really didn't know anything about your story of how you got into the industry. And so it was really interesting reading your bio, which has a lot of great tidbits about your career. And, you know, Caitlin had mentioned that your dad was a vet, you grew up in New York. It sounds like you went to Finger Lakes quite a bit. So talk to us about your journey into the industry and, you know, some of those early experiences of shadowing your dad and being around the track at Finger Lakes.
Yeah. So, you know, I think everyone has a story of how they got in. You know, I was just a young kid that, you know, my dad was a partner in a vet practice at Finger Lakes Racetrack. He practiced there for about 35 years. So as long as I was a kid, he was there at the racetrack, and that meant he was gone a lot of days during the summer. So, you know, it was always fun when we might be able to go up and visit him and grab an ice cream cone or something, watch a race or two from the backside. Never got to go front side, but always got to go backside, and you'd hear the jockeys, you know, yakking and whatever they might be saying going into the turn. So that was a cool way to kind of experience it and to see it from the backside aspect, you know, the care of the horse. You know, being a son of a veterinarian, you could see somebody, you know, treat a sick horse and make him better. So as I got older, you know, I got to spend a little bit more time, winter time when there was no racing, he did a lot of layup work. Jimmy Bond still had his farm in Western New York, the Rochester area where Finger Lakes is from. So, like, I remember as a kid going to his barn on the backside of Finger Lakes, and then he got Mrs. Payson as a client. and moved off to the Naira circuits, but he would lay up his good horses over the wintertime sometimes at his farms, like horses like Will's Way, Barons, some of these horses my dad would take care of. So I'd like go and, you know, watch bandage changes and do things. Then as I got older, a lot of people probably don't remember X-ray plates where you have to develop X-rays, but I did a lot of holding of X-ray plates in the summertime, and then they take them and you develop them in the room just like any other photograph, sterilizing like syringes. Like I had to do all the worst jobs, like stocking the truck and stuff, but like you got to be around it, so it was a lot of fun. But you know, probably until I was about 19, 20 years old, like I didn't really expect myself to go into the thoroughbred industry. It was like one of those, like thinking you were going to do something prior to it and then going after that and realizing this isn't really what I want to do. So I thought I was going to go into like be a lawyer or politics or something. Went to school in New York City, and just after about a year and a half living in the Bronx, I was like, I need green grass again. And, you know, there was like some important things around that time, like Smarty Jones was a big horse that I followed. And so like Zenyatta was a horse that grabbed me when I was fairly young. You know, just remember, you know, you work a lot of holidays in this industry. So like, I think she broke her maiden on Thanksgiving Day, and I was like waiting to go back and like do afternoon chores or something. Right. So like you got to see her break her maiden. It was like one of those maiden victories that you see, and it's like, whoa, like that was a really good horse. So then like you followed her on every single race. It was kind of cool to have witnessed that kind of from the beginning. So, you know, little tidbits like that definitely draw you in. So like I told my parents I was going to go to UK. So I transferred down, packed up my my car and headed down, lasted about one semester playing hockey, and then jumped in with both feet into working at Hillandale back in like 04. So I think I'm going on 20 years here in Lexington now. So yeah, it was Finger Lakes, getting to see it from like that side, you know, from the veterinary side. The medical side was obviously something that definitely helped me when I got to Kentucky. You know, I started off at Hillandale as a night watchman, foaling, and then I would stick around and hold mares for the vet in the morning. You know, I knew how to hold horses for the vet and be around a vet. And so I was kind of useful. So, I mean, that was like, that was just pure education there. Was, you know, being around all these great mares that Hillandale had at the time, and kind of when I started with them was their ascension, not only in the stallion game. You know, Candy Ride and Medalli d'Oro were both young sires there at the time. But just like John's like expansion of his broodmare band and the class and the bloodlines that he was bringing in, just being around those horses early on in my career were like super invaluable.
So one common thread that sticks out to me about like your young life and your entrance into the thoroughbred industry, and then something I know about you personally, is you are obviously not scared off by hard work. Because I can imagine growing up, you know, being a track veterinarian is not easy. It's truly, I mean, I don't even know fully, but I assume it's a lifestyle. Like you said, you know, the horses are racing, or they're there year round. And anybody involved with horses knows that it's something, you know, just put them in their stall and you go home, check on them, you know, 12 hours later. So what was that like? I mean, just as a young kid, you know, seeing how hard your father was working and just thinking like, but this is amazing. Like, this is something that I want to be a part of.
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely something. I mean, I'm sure a lot of young kids, they might choose a certain path that their parents don't necessarily want them to choose. And so, you know, the thoroughbred industry, I can say, wasn't exactly one of those deals that like, it was welcome per se, but it wasn't like a hard no. But, you know, it's not an easy lifestyle per se. And I think that's something, as you dive into it and you do it longer, like it is a lifestyle, and it's a great lifestyle. Like once you just accept that, like, it's long hours and it's hard work, but like the rewards are so great, then, you know, it doesn't feel like work every day. But yeah, I mean, that probably definitely helped, you know, growing up around dairy farms and where my dad was a vet, and, you know, you never knew when a phone call was going to come and the colic was going to happen, or, you know, you just saw that it was long hours, long days. And so it was probably a little bit easier to transition into that as like a 20-year-old kid, because you just knew with it. But I also, like if you're hungry for it and the more you're ready, you want to chew off, the more they'll give you around here too. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if you're willing to work the nights and then stick around and do vet work, like they would love to have people do that. Right. So it's like the reward you get from the hard work is well worth it. Now, there was a lot of parties or what have you that I was a little disappointed I may not have been able to go to, or maybe I stuck around a little too late to show back up to work the next morning. But, you know, it's a hell of a lifestyle and it's very rewarding. And, you know, when people tell you if you find something you love and it's not, you just don't work a day in your life, I will say that you still feel like you work some days in your life, but you can definitely look back and say it was well worth it. And it's pretty awesome. You get to see a lot of sunrises and you get to network with people too. The people you get to meet that flow in and out of our industry is amazing, because, you know, a lot of people that own horses, not only the people that I got to learn from, you know, who I worked for, they certainly were successful and definitely at the top of the game. But the people that flow in and out of our game that, you know, you get to meet because they own the horses, you know, early on, George Krikorian, who owned Hollywood Story and Star that we had at Hillendale, you know, Bob Baffert was coming around to see all of his horses. So like you get to be close to that. You get to hear. If you just listen, you get to learn so much. So, and then you get other people that, you know, come in and out of our industry that have been successful in their businesses. And, you know, you just get to pick their brains at times. So it's pretty cool.
So, Sean, when you decided to make that pivot from the law and politics route into the equine industry, was there an aspirational job that you had in mind that you thought, well, I'm going into the thoroughbred industry, this is what I want to be someday? Or how did you choose the pathway that got you to where you are now?
So I had full intentions of going down to Kentucky, going to school, and then winding back up at Saratoga. You know, I fully wanted to probably be more of a trainer, racetrack oriented racing. I had never been to Lexington, Kentucky in my life.
Did you even tour UK before you?
I came down and met with the hockey coach. That was kind of like, come down and do this. I ended up graduating. It took some time, but I did come down, spent like maybe 24 hours here with my mom, and then we were back home. You know, had a younger sister, we had stuff going on, so loaded up I had a two-door Chevy, like one of those mid-sized kind of like 10-year-old like SUV things, you know, packed it up to the brim and off I went. And I never went home afterwards. I never left. Wow. So like I totally was planning on just coming down, but then like in January of that year, it was foaling season. I went around, I applied to a bunch of farms. I got lucky to get a phone call from Hillendale, and part of it was a reference. So that was lucky. And they were like, if you want a night watch, we have a position. So I started night watch and I showed up at like 6 o'clock at night, and I worked till 6 o'clock the next morning. But, you know, first night I worked, Silver Bullet Day, who's a Hall of Famer, like, we fold her out. So like, you know, you show up and like first day you're folding out a Hall of Famer, like, you know, I was kind of hooked. Stone Street was just getting into the game. So like all of their mares were there to fold them out. You know, I can go down the line of the great mares that got to go through that barn. And like, I think we fold out over 100 mares in the barn that year. So like every night was a lot of action. Like I couldn't get enough of it. And then, you know, you want to go to the shed in the morning, like hop on the van. Like, yeah, I've never been to Claiborne Farm. So like rode in the back of the van, like peeking out the window down Paris Pike, you know? So it was just like, it was definitely love at first sight when I got to Lexington. And I was hooked. So I never left. And then that's where I kind of went into the breeding game. Did that at Hillendale for about 8 years, and just kind of at that point, you know, there really wasn't anywhere else for me to kind of climb the ladder at that point there. So some opportunities opened up, and I ended up getting traded to Windstar from Paul's Mill, U.S. Ranger, and all the stallions got bought. Bellamy Road, Artie Schiller, U.S. Ranger, and Summer Bird, they got bought by Windstar. And so I got bought with the Stallions. We walked off the we walked off the van at the same time, and that's when they had just opened their training center. Uncle Mo had gone through there, or some other ones. So like, they kind of wanted me to work with Stallions. And I was like, well, you know, you got this training center. I've always been more racing, and wouldn't mind to get a little bit closer to that again. And got lucky that Richard Budge needed an assistant, so he hired me, and I spent 2.5 years as assistant. But like where you say, you know, for my first 10 years working in Kentucky, you know, I think my whole idea in my head of where I was going to go was to be a farm manager, general manager of farm, you know, those type of aspirations. But I actually applied for the broodmare manager job at Windstar after being there about 3 years, and I didn't get hired. So, but that's where when they didn't hire me, but they said, you know, if you wanted to go do this in the breeding shed for the winter time, then we'll let you do a little bit of something with racing and bloodstock in the summertime. So, for 3 years, I teased every mare and washed every mare that came through the breeding shed, and I think 1 year we did like 3,200 covers. So, that was quite the experience, I can tell you that much. But anyways, if I had gotten hired to be the broodmare manager of Windstar, I mean, I'd probably still be, you know, doing foaling mares and doing that and not have gone the bloodstock route. So, I mean, you hear it all the time. I mean, there's plenty of sports teams I was cut from, and there's plenty of jobs that I haven't gotten. So, you know, some of the things you don't get lead to the greater things you can get. So got to just stick with it.
Yeah, and let's talk about that a little bit, about your transition into the office, because when I started at Windstar in the early 20-teens, you were already in the office kind of like helping to run the bloodstock show. You were still very involved in, you know, the broodmare and training. You're obviously like very close with everybody on the farm. But what was that like going from nights and mornings and foaling and, you know, early mornings at the training track to being in an office?
One benefit is I got to play a little more golf, but you know, a little bit more structure, but at the same time, like, you kind of you realize, you know, what you miss about being out on the farm too. So what's really nice about a bloodstock role, especially, is it's not necessarily a 9-to-5 job. So I was still, you know, I was assistant racing manager and director of bloodstock there. So, you know, it was a lot of early mornings still going to the tracks, you know, seeing our horses breeze, which was fun, you know, getting to be around Hall of Fame trainers like Steve Asmussen and Todd Pletcher. You know, you can go down the list of the people that you get to just watch and learn from. So, like, I'll never forget, you know, there's certain times where your horses come about. And so we had a gray horse that was with Steve Asmussen, who was named Creator. He ended up going to win the Belmont Stakes. And so he was unraced, and he was in at Churchill Downs. So I'd be going up every week to watch him breeze. And, you know, one of the first weeks I was up there, and I was like terrified, you know, Steve Asmussen, you know, am I allowed to, you know, make sure Elliot calls and, you know, he make sure, you know, this guy just isn't showing up on the doorstep at 5:30 in the morning, you know. So got to, you know, be alongside him, watch these breezes, but like Creator breeze, but then this Chestnut colt breeze, and he was walking the shed with him, and he's like, this Candy Ride colt can really run. He's like, this horse can run. So like, I'm like, oh. So like, he would breeze the same day every week as Creator. So like, I'd watch this horse and I bet on him first time, which was nice because he kind of was a little under the radar. I think he went off like 4 or 5 to 1, but he won easily, but it ended up being gun runner. So like, you know, it's just like this little unassuming chestnut that kind of like walked around. So I got like three months before anyone knew who gun runner even was, it was kind of fun to watch him breeze in the mornings. And it was definitely worth getting up at 4:30 in the morning to get to Louisville. So that made the trade-off, you know, the being able to go back and relax in an office the rest of the day wasn't a bad trade-off for getting up at 4:30 in the morning. But the other thing was it made me really, you know, you learn how to, you know, cold calling in this business is a good trait to have. And whether it's a handshake, going up and meeting somebody at a sale, at a race, picking up the phone to call a breeder because maybe that mare can go to a stallion that you think works well. You just never know what those things can lead to. Sometimes they lead to really good jobs. Sometimes they lead to good bloodstock deals. But you know, you gotta turn over every stone in this business. That's for sure.
Caitlin and I have talked with other guests on this podcast about the importance of still being able to pick up the phone and have that, you know, in person, face to face, or over the phone relationship rather than emailing or sending a text to people. And I'll say one of the things that we've noticed through Amplify, and not to sound like, you know, kids these days can't call people on the phone, but there is still so much value to picking up the phone and having an actual conversation with someone. And I think that sometimes gets overlooked at times. So I'm glad that you highlighted the importance of the, you know, the relationship building in the industry and probably how that's really helped you in the progression of your career over time too, in developing that skill.
Yeah, it's definitely been invaluable. It can be nerve wracking at times. That's for sure. But you also have to remember, I mean, I've always felt like, you know, you can get a horse deal done through emotion versus like reality sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, you can get the pick up the phone and you start talking about, you know, great win, you know, how, you know, you get the emotions going, they start feeling good, you know, and then they start liking you on the other end of the phone. And then, you know, you start to tell them about how great this mating could be for their mare and blah, blah, blah. And, or, you know, then you go to, well, will you sell your horse? You know, you kind of get them on your side. And, but you also remember, like, you deal with a lot of people from different generations. So, you know, I might be calling an 80-year-old man or woman and they don't know how to send an email. Like, you never know what kind of paths you cross with people and how they work. You know, some people still want faxes. I can't say that I'm the best at doing that, but I can get it done. You know, and that's the one thing I've realized, even through text messages, is you can lose a little bit of that emotion. People can, you know, their emotion is going to translate that, that text. So, you know, you might get started on the wrong foot.
We have a lot of young people who will reach out to Amplify for advice or, you know, information about careers in the industry, who will say, I'm going to be a bloodstock agent someday. And I think they frequently see this kind of glamorous aspect.
Glamorous.
To it. Like, yes. Yeah, I'm going to learn about pedigrees and I'm going to buy horses for people and it's going to be really easy.
And they think they're just going to walk in and be the big shot, right?
Yeah.
They're just going to walk in and find that one horse and it's going to be all smooth sailing from there.
But here you're now, you know, VP of bloodstock for one of the most successful, you know, racing partnerships in the US, and you have years of hands-on experience and, you know, waking up at whatever 2 a.m. to foal mares and being at the track by 5:30 a.m. to watch horses breeze. How have those years of, you know, the in-person and hands-on experience contributed to what you're doing now?
Well, our industry and being around horses and buying horses is the easiest thing you can do in this, in our industry. So that's why you see a lot of people buy horses. And then after a while, when they don't buy very good horses, they don't have anything to fall back on. And listen, clients come and go in this business very quickly. Our industry is supported by discretionary income for the most part. So if people don't want to keep spending the money, then you may not have a job. But experience, you know, whether it's getting the phone call that a horse is colicking, getting the phone call that the horse is hurt at the track, you know, having a mare rush to the clinic because of a dystocia when a foaling doesn't go right, confirmational issues, you know, working with a blacksmith when they come and trim foals every 2 weeks. Those are things, especially when you're in bloodstock management and bloodstock, is that experience to be able to know exactly what's going on with your horse when either the farm, the train, somebody calls you. Knowing, you know, having maybe gone through a situation, you may have more experience than the person that's dealing with it. You know, I think an invaluable lesson I learned very early on from a farm manager at Hillendale was you know, anybody can take care of a horse on an easy day when it's all, you know, you go out, you feed it twice a day, everything's going smooth, you know, the birds are chirping, sun's up, you know, everything's growing great. But it's when, you know, when you're calling 911 and there's an emergency, that's when you got to be the most effective. And so one thing is definitely, you know, staying calm, you know, not to go down the litany list of bad things that can happen with a horse or that I've seen happen with a horse, but they do happen, and you have to take it in stride. But if you're the person there who's handling the situation, making the calls, it's a whole lot easier and a whole lot better if you've been around it before and seen it. And sometimes it's being emotional support for the person that's doing it as well, right? When you're sitting there dealing with a mare that you've had for, you know, 10 years and things aren't going real well, you might need a little pick me up too. So, you know, if you've seen it go right, that certainly helps. But just being able to handle the situations that's in front of you, being able to relay, you know, for what we do in the Eclipse Thoroughbred Partners and the racing partnership is we bring a lot of new people into this industry. So, you know, they're drawn in because they see our horses winning big races and our partners holding up trophies. But we've been around this industry a long time, and you know, unfortunately, that's not every horse that comes to the stable. So it's also educating these people when things, you know, this horse is hurt, we're gonna have to give it 90 days off. It's not the end of the world, but this is, you know, this is the route we're going. And so, you know, being able to relay that effectively and in an educational way is always, you know, that's experience can't replace that. So
that's a great point, that, you know, the importance of experience in like how that plays into your communication and how you relay and educate others about what's going on is so invaluable. So that's really interesting to hear. And Sean, what is a day in your current job like? Like what is your typical office? I mean, you already said that it's not a 9-to-5 type job, yeah. But like, what is that like working with clients, working on the bloodstock aspect, you know, watching horses train? How do you balance all those things in a typical day?
I do have my own little farm now, so I get to touch horses every day, which having been doing this for about 20 years now, that's the one thing that I realized I did miss quite a bit was just that, you know, that daily kind of touching of a horse. I got a little bit of it, you know, in working for the big farms and still kind of around a little bit when you get to go out and see foals and yearlings and stuff. But that's my therapy is, you know, going out and spend about an hour in the morning, an hour in the evening when things go well, just kind of being around horses, watching them, you know, you learn from that too, right? And I remember a Kentucky horseman, Joe Seitz, works for Brookdale. His family's been in a long time. He's got a farm too. And, you know, same thing, he says, you know, just being able to be around it on a small scale and touching them and dealing with the problems, you know, that just helps him with his clients and also kind of staying in the know. You know, breeding season is in full effect right now. And you wouldn't be surprised the things that happen in Kentucky, you know, like MRLS, was it MRLS or the mare reproductive loss syndrome when I first started had just happened where it like wiped out like 60% or something of the foal crop, which is wild. You know, 2 years ago, there was this kind of new bug that was giving all the babies, you know, diarrhea. And so like, you know, just kind of knowing that or kind of just, it helps you stay in the know of the industry and knowing what people are dealing with. But it's therapy for me. So I get out there, I've got a couple of horses, some yearlings, mess around with some mares. Some days, you know, for horses that are in Kentucky, I'll go to the track. If we have horses here, that kind of ramps up more now that Keeneland's getting going and over the summertime with the majority of horses down in Florida for us. But it's, you know, I've got 2-year-old sales going on right now. So I'll go down to all those. I go down to Ocala, you know, starting December about once a month. I'll start to go down to see all of our 2-year-olds, see how they're progressing. You know, it's communicating with the people that you entrust to deal with your horses. keeping an eye on them. I'm not going to say keeps them honest, but it keeps everyone on the same page, right? Mm-hmm. So I do believe when you see a horse every single day, you might not see the subtle changes every once in a while. So going there once a month, communicating with our excellent pre-trainers that we have, and like Susan Montaigne, Maida Murphy at Bridalwood Farm, Ocala Stud, the O'Farrell family, they're excellent at what they do. And just going down and seeing them, you know, they might be contemplating something and say, yeah, let's give that horse 30 days off. We should do that. We're totally cool doing that. Like where some clients may not, you know, they want to run quicker. So just open communication with everyone is really good. So that goes to daily emails. I do need to spend a little bit of time in the office. And then we try to really over communicate to our partnership group. So this time of year, I'm going out to see all of our new foals, checking our yearlings because yearling placement will be going on soon for the yearling sales. You know, deciding, are we going to race this horse? Are we going to sell this horse? So, you know, just getting out and about and seeing some people. But we got chain dragging to do. We've got mowing to do. All the things that the big farms do, the small farms do too. So it changes every day, which is the great thing about the thoroughbred industry is just get up and enjoy it, because every day really is different. And the horses give you everything and tons. So.
So do you have a lot of staff on your farm, or do you do a lot of the hands-on stuff yourself as well?
I have a staff of one myself.
You are very hands-on.
Yeah. My wife, who is a veterinarian, she will come out and help me with some eye ointments or some shots every once in a while. But I am the land manager, the equine manager, I love it. I mean, listen, 7-8 horses. We're breeding a couple mares, so it's not over strenuous, but definitely when you get a yearling that doesn't want to cooperate and you kind of wish maybe you had somebody else there with you, but it's all
good. So, are you actually foaling the mares at your personal farm?
No,
okay.
No. We let other friends and family take care of that. So. Listen, I'm a big believer. You know, I do it because I have the ability to do maiden and barren mares, right? Or some yearlings. But you know, foaling, it's a lot can go wrong quickly. So, let the people that are, you know, have the night watch, have all the supplies right there, you know, are close to a clinic and available, you know, let them handle that. And then, you know, something I've learned over the years is, you know, horses need to be raised in big fields with big groups. So, I'm, you know, although it costs me a whole lot less to have them on my property, the best thing I can do for that foal that is my homebred is to make sure it gets raised in a large group, learns the competitiveness, you know, make them want to be the first of the herd too. So, when you're out by yourself, it's pretty easy to think you're number one.
I love that. This is one of our greatest episodes. Like, I genuinely mean that, because you really illustrated how just the trajectory of your career and, you know, the influence of being hands-on, how that's helped you in an office type role, which I think a lot of young people at some point try to shift from the hands-on stuff into office type positions, but highlighting the importance of maintaining that connection to the horse and how that, you know, kind of continues to motivate you in other ways too. So that is really, really cool. And okay, I have a really silly question to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyways. There is a total eclipse coming up on April 8th. Please tell me that Eclipse Thoroughbred Partners are doing something like an Eclipse watch party or an Eclipse promo or something, because you guys are undoubtedly going to get a bunch of random new people coming to your website, Googling Eclipse, and they end up at Eclipse Thoroughbred Partners website. So how are you guys capitalizing on that?
Well, that not all that information necessarily feeds down to the bloodstock department. That would rest with Kelsey Hughes and Aaron Wellman. They are the inventive group of our small group. I'm sure there's going to be something. Aaron's a master at spinning all of that fun stuff into our group and everything. Unfortunately, the path of totality doesn't come too close to us. So I don't see him flying in from San Diego for any song and dance per se, but I definitely think we'll be highlighting it, and it'll be a fun little play, probably in the newsletter for sure.
Well, I will say my mother is flying down from Fargo, North Dakota, because it's just a quick 3-hour drive north of Lexington to be in the total path of, or the path of totality. So if anybody wants to road trip with the Montplaisir family,
there you go.
They are invited.
I just want to make sure I have my glasses. I don't want to be the guy that looks up in the sun and next thing you know, my retinas
burns your retinas. Shouldn't laugh at that, but it is true. I've been reading about it. So get your safe and approved eclipse glasses, folks.
Anybody, there you go. Maybe that is what we should do.
Yeah, that's a perfect eclipse promo. That is so funny. Caitlin, any other questions before we kind of wind it down?
Are you bringing up your daughters in the industry?
My daughters have a pony, thanks to their mom. My daughter's fourth birthday is opening day at Keeneland. She's already requested to go. You know, listen, they're going to live in Lexington, Kentucky, so they're going to be around it. I think it's great to have a wide breadth of experience in all kinds of things. Our industry can take you all over the country. Like I said, you know, I've been to South Korea to see a stallion. Obviously, I think now more than ever, you know, Newgate is always trying to recruit people down to work a sales season. So getting to Australia and some other places, take full advantage of it, especially when you're younger. It's very easy. You know, if you can lead a horse and take care of a horse, you can do it anywhere in the world. So mm-hmm. you can use that to travel. But I would suggest, you know, always finish school. I would like, not to sound like the progressive commercial, but, you know, it's definitely valuable. You can always rely on it. But I think, you know, as somebody who kind of was like, not pushed away from the industry, I think when as a kid, like the harder you're pushed away from something, kind of the more you want it. So we'll see. I mean, listen, I got to do parenting, right? So, I mean, we're going to try to keep all the bad decisions at a minimum, but.
Already said pony and.
I'd rather maybe want to, like, you know, pin hook a yearling instead of get into the show jumping world if you had that.
Oh my gosh. That's
when you said South Korea, Sean, I had this memory of, it must have been pre-COVID, of running into you in the middle of the Atlanta Hartsfield Airport. You were coming off off the train. I was getting on. I think I was heading to like a Breeders' Cup, winning your in race somewhere. And I just like briefly passed Sean. He was like, I'm going to South Korea for 36 hours. I don't know if you remember that.
I don't remember running into you. It was pretty wild. It was pretty wild. So it was a Sunday. I was at Keeneland watching Breezers. Take Charge Indy had gotten sold to the
Korean Racing. That's who it was. Mm-hmm.
And there was a clause that after like his 2-year-olds ran, after his 3-year-olds ran, the syndicate could buy him back for X price. And so he was proving that he probably should get brought back. But there was still like 90 to 120 days before we even had to like put in this, you know, request that we're going to bring the horse back. Right. But in the place that we worked, in their fashion, we can do it now. So I was due to go on vacation that Friday. And so Sunday I was told you can get to South Korea and back in time. I was like, well, okay. So I know nothing about how to go to Korea or anything. So June Park, he's a Korean who lives here in Lexington. He was able to help, because I was originally going to go to a place called Jeju Island, which I was told like that's where the main breeding portion was, because it was like I was supposed to kind of go incognito and show up to like inspect this horse, like this isn't going to go good. And so luckily I didn't end up going there because the horse was like at the other farm, which was inland. And so flew. So I guess I saw you on the way there. I flew like Monday, got down there at midnight, loaded a plane, 14 hours to South Korea, got off there the next day, which would have been like Wednesday their time at like 4 a.m. Luckily, somebody picked me up. We ended up going to the Korean Racing Authority. It was like 9 a.m. by the time I got there in Seoul, South Korea, which, I mean, I'm just a kid from Avon, New York, where like we've never graduated over 100, right? So like you go to a place that has 10 million people, you're like, this is a big city. Like, I'm glad somebody pointed me in the right direction here. This would have been bad. And so get over to the Korean Racing Authority. They're not overly pleased that I'm there to come bring back maybe one of their better stallions that they've ever had in Korea as a young horse. So I go with like an intern on like a 4-hour drive south of Seoul, go see the horse. It takes about 15 minutes to see the horse. I had to have another cup of coffee. It's very respectful to have a cup of coffee. So I think I was on about 20 cups of coffee by the time I got back to the hotel that night. Got back in the car. Rush hour in Seoul is just outrageous. Got back to our hotel by the time, like 10 o'clock that night, I think. Had enough energy to order a cheeseburger, of all things, from room service. And then the people that were doing the importing and exporting, they took me to a nice lunch, and I was back at the airport the next day at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Wow.
And was back in Lexington by like 6 p.m. Thursday, I think it was. So,
and how long's that really flight?
14 hours each way.
Okay.
So it was really, really neat to go to South Korea, and like, it looks like an awesome place to go and see the racing. Mm-hmm. And they've done a great job, but it was really neat to go see their breeding facilities and their training facilities. What they're doing is really cool. And obviously their breeding program, you know, didn't really get started until like 46, 47, you know, after World War II. So, that's kind of crazy when you think about it. They've had a couple of Breeders' Cup starters and stuff. You know, that's really only about four generations of breeding. So I would love to go back where I could actually see it and experience it. But it was wild. It's just one of those stories that, you know, the horses bring into your life. So it's just one of many, that's for sure.
An adventure only the thoroughbred industry can take you on.
Yeah.
That is amazing. That is so, so funny. Sean, what are you most excited about for this year? Whether it's racing, your own farm, Eclipse, your daughter.
Yeah, I want to know. Definitely want to know what's next. What's the next, you know, 5 to 10 years look like?
Well, I'm loving Eclipse. So hopefully, you know, we can continue to grow Eclipse. Aaron and his partner, Brian Spearman, have done an unbelievable job. Obviously, Kelsey's been there from day one. It's what they do is incredible, and what they've been able to accomplish, over 20 grade one wins already. So hopefully I can just be part of that team and help pad the stats some more. It's a great company to work for. I hope Aaron doesn't listen to this too closely, but it's unbelievable to have a boss that lives, you know, in a different time zone out in San Diego. So, but you know, he trusts me. At least you got to have responsibility in this industry. But so I hope, you know, we've got some 2-year-olds that are really exciting. You know, but we do more than just racing. We've got a boutique broodmare band. So we've had a couple homebred winners for our partners this year. It's kind of fun where our partners get to experience racing a horse and then going through the breeding process, you know, seeing this horse from day one, watching them grow, and then, you know, watching them win a race. It's the full process. It's awesome. And then we've got a couple of young stallions that we're invested in, you know, Independence Hall at Windstar, his first yearlings, and then Aloha West, who we won the Breeders' Cup Sprint with, his first foals are hitting this year. So seeing all those foals hit the ground, you know, that's when the dreams begin, right? So, you know, anytime a new foal hits the ground, you never know if that's the Oaks or the Derby winner or something that, you know, is just one of those that you get to watch. I mean, like Indian Blessing was a horse that was born and raised at Hillendale when I was there. And like, I personally don't remember this, because of just the busyness and everything. But the guy we're working with, he swears to this day that she was born in the field and we brought her in you know, the muck tub, you know, like he went out, instead of carrying him, you know, he put him in like the wheelbarrow and brought her into the barn. And next thing you know, she's 2-year-old champion. So, wow. You know, those stories, I mean, it's pretty cool when you get to work with horses, you know, like I said, Silver Bullet Day, the very first day I got to Full of Mare, and being around Azari and Madcap Escapade, and then going through the Triple Crown with Justify. And, you know, last year we won 2 grade ones with Locked and Candied, you know, Fall Stars weekend at Keeneland. Like, you know, you just want more of it because it tastes so good, right? You can't beat getting into the Derby winner circle or even like a maiden special weight winner that, you know, just wins and you get to celebrate and there's nothing better than winning a horse race. So I look forward to winning horse races. That's that's what I look forward to.
Heck yeah. Well, hopefully it's a big year ahead, and thank you for sharing a little bit of your time with us. And I actually hope that Aaron listens to this episode because it was awesome.
And, yes. And yeah, I'm curious, just one more thing before we wrap up. I do want to know a little bit, like on the Eclipse side, you know, and talking about bringing your clients like full experience through the breeding to the, you know, winner circle, hopefully, like collectively your clients, what does their experience with horses range from?
Oh, that's a great question.
I mean, it ranges from zero to people that are big owners in our game that own 100% of horses. You know, Aaron's done an unbelievable job building our brand. And so, you know, like partners like Gary Barber and Robert LaPenta, you know, Madicat Stables, you know, we have a lot of people that we team up with. And then you get people that maybe they're just a $2 gambler, or they grew up in Lexington or Louisville and they watched it from afar, but never, you know, had the ability to get into it until now. All over the country too. We have Canadian partners. We've got people from the middle of, you know, the country that don't have a racetrack within 1,000 miles of them. But what they all share is they all share a love for it. They all share a real interest for it. They want to learn about it and they want to experience it. So, you know, we always try to remember, we basically go into it like, not to speak for everyone in our company, but we kind of go into it like nobody has any experience, and it's our job to help, you know, educate them on our industry, our business, how it all works, the process, the good, the bad. And, you know, also we focus on aftercare a lot too. You know, it's not only do we breed horses, but we also take care of, horses that have been through the stable. So we have a Blue Moon, aftercare program that every horse in our stable feeds into. So there's always that, capital available, you know, if we see a horse that we need to go and find a better situation for. So, some become broodmares in our broodmare band, and, some we will donate to new vocations, or they become track ponies. But, you know, not only is there a responsibility as an owner to the horse when it's on the racetrack, but there's also a responsibility for that horse. You know, it's aftercare has come a very long way, even since I've been in the industry. But, you know, it's a big part of it. And these horses, they live a long time, and they bring, you know, like I said, you know, some people will have stories, and you see photos of people that have had a retired racehorse in their backyard basically as just a pet for 15, 20 years. But, you know, that 15, 20 years of that horse's life, what he gave to that person is invaluable. So these horses, they give everything to us on the racetrack. So we always try to give it back to them too.
Sean, do you ride? Should have asked that earlier, but you've done all these other things. Like, do you have enough?
There are some pictures of me from back in the day and on some ponies. But at about 23, 24 years of age, I lost all confidence on the back of a horse. I mean, I'll go on a trail ride or something, like a bomb-proof pony, but like, I feel like I'm 1,000 feet in the air. I don't know what it is. But I have no fear of them on the ground, but I put one foot in the stirrup and it's like, oof, I guess maybe it's just getting old.
That's fine. Everybody's got their thing and their niche in the industry, and riding is not for everyone. But
I do love that you touched on all of that, though, because I think it is so important, you know, and as we were discussing at the beginning, education is a big part of why we do this podcast and educating not only young people, but anybody interested in learning more about the industry. Education was, you know, when I first started at Windstar, I didn't have much experience in the industry, and truly being educated is what has kept me, you know, thriving and learning and like hungry to stay in the industry. It's constantly learning. And I think it's so important, and it does such a justice to our sport to constantly be bringing people in and, you know, educating and showing them the good and the bad. And, but just, you know, the realities of what, like, what it takes to work around horses or to own horses, to be with horses.
Yeah. I second that. I think that's amazing. And, you know, it all ties into transparency, which is one of the most important parts of our industry too, like showing all aspects of horse ownership. And horses, you know, can be unpredictable, but it's an amazing journey. And so being able to bring people into that, regardless of what level of knowledge or experience they have, is really special. So it's awesome what you guys are doing. And, you know, glad that you're sharing in our educational mission. And, you know, if we can ever help with anything, let us know. But you're now a friend of the Amplify family, Amplify podcast. So you're always welcome back. And I'm sure we'll run into you soon in person, probably out of Keeneland, just a couple weeks away. Yep. Next week.
Not too long away. And thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. And thanks for everything you guys do. It's wonderful that you're out there and spreading the good word and trying to get new people into the business. That's what fuels it. And that's what keeps the lifeblood of it along. So anything we can do to help, just let us know.
Thank you so much, Sean.
Thanks, Ron.
You can talk about the weather for the first couple of minutes before you dive in for a horse.
Sorry. My college diploma just fell on me. I'll edit that out.